The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Not since the crisis in 2015 has Europe seen images quite like this. The Deputy Prime Minister describes it as an invasion.
It is obviously organised, financed and prepared. It is an act of war, because if we go on at 6,000 migrants a day, it means collapse for Italian society. I said it at the beginning. What is happening in Lampedusa is the death of Europe.
7,000 migrants crossing the Mediterranean in just 3 days to an island with space for just 400. The storm at the beginning of the week had created a bottleneck on the North African beaches, but by Wednesday conditions were calmer. Nearly 200 boats crossed in just a few hours. There are thousands more who are still waiting to cross.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. It's been a while since I've been here in the hot seat. We've got, as usual, lots of ways for you to listen to, lots of new ways for you to listen as well, or to watch the show. As always, you can watch us on thetrumpet.com. Rumble is something that I think has really taken off more recently, a platform that I've got more and more respect for as the UK government just seems to go to war with them and is even kind of threatening them and trying to shut them down. I guess this might be going out over Live from America TV. I'm not sure about that. We often try to get this up on Facebook and as many different places that we can. So you have no excuse not to listen. However you listen, we're very glad that you're joining us today. I'm coming to you from our studio in Edstone, England. And I want to talk to you today about the massive migrant crisis underway in the European Union. I think this is rapidly becoming a huge story. There's a migrant crisis underway in so many places that you look. There's one in the United States. We've got one here in the UK with people arriving in these small boats. All of those are a big deal. All of those are worth talking about. But what is happening in the EU is worth talking about as well. There's a special dynamic there. The clip that you saw from the start is from Lampedusa. It's a little island just off the coast of Africa, and it's become front and center, really, of the European migrant crisis. I think we've got, yeah, you can see, I can almost point it to you right there. It's this little island owned by Italy, kind of between mainland Africa and Malta. Much easier to get there than it is to get to the rest of Italy, and so you get a lot of migrants showing up. They're really the front line. So just with Europe as a whole, you had 500,000 migrants apply for asylum within the European Union in the first half of the year. That's up 30% compared to last year. It's the highest for this time period since the kind of the big migrant crisis of 2014, 2015. And now you get what's happening in Lampedusa. Really, those statistics came out kind of end of August. And then I think it was the footage from Lampedusa that really catapulted it into people's attention. That small island that you saw, though, it's got a population of about 6,000. And then right around September 12th, September 13th, 7,000 migrants arrive. More migrants than they have locals. There's some clips circulating online of migrants breaking out of the asylum center, setting up roadblocks. We've got a clip that we can play you of that quickly now. For Lampedusa, it's a bit of a temporary crisis. They kind of ship these migrants onto Sicily just as soon as they can, just to kind of get them out of the island. But that doesn't help the overall situation with the European Union. And all across the EU, countries are struggling with this. 30% of all asylum applications went to Germany. You know, Germany, very famously, not bordering the Middle East or the Mediterranean, factors that have played an incredibly important part in its history. And yet they're getting about a third of all migrant asylum seekers. Germany has this, thanks to Angela Merkel, Germany has this reputation of being utopia for migrants. You know, this is the place that you want to go. They're going to treat you well. And so they're arriving in Italy and some of these other places, and especially coming up through Turkey and into the Balkans, and they're moving on up to Germany. That's having a huge impact now on German politics. You know, I think this is a really interesting dynamic where Angela Merkel's migrant-friendly, quote-unquote, policies, I mean, we'll talk later about whether they're really migrant-friendly, but that has now meant that Germany has some of the biggest political reaction against migrants, some of the biggest pressure to change its politics and shut them down, because all of the migrants are now gravitating towards Germany. I mean, over the summer, one of the big political debates has been, do swimming pools require round-the-clock police protection? Like this, that German swimming pools have been a staple of the news over the summer. That's something you could expect to see on your nightly news there. Some pools have been unable to remain open because their staff keeps quitting, because they're fed up of, you know, pool staff aren't paid well, and they're fed up of having to deal with fights between migrants and migrants assaulting women, and they have to deal with it. And these attacks come predominantly from Muslim migrants coming into Germany at these swimming pools. And they'll talk about the violence, saying, you know, that won't be on the news. But it's rare to see someone that's got the courage to make any general statements about where these migrants are from. And of course, it's not, you know, everybody knows, it's not all migrants coming from the Middle East doing this, but that doesn't mean that you can't talk in fairly accurate generalizations about what is happening here. So this has already been impacting European politics the first half of the year. And then look at what we've had in the region of northern France recently. You had about 3,000 die in Morocco's earthquake over the summer. And hopefully we'll have some pictures we might be able to show you of some of that devastation. And you've got that. And then in Libya, you've got even worse devastation coming from a flood that broke a couple of dams. I mean, they're looking at over 10,000 people dead. I'm still not sure where we are with the death toll on that. It could reach as high as 20,000 potentially. The city of Derna, it had 100,000 people. It's largely been destroyed. We've got a clip showing what has been done to that city. This is clip 3.
These drone shots from the city of Derna give a sense of the devastation and the difficulties getting aid to where it is needed. The city on the Mediterranean coast was particularly badly hit. This was the port before the floods, with its population of around 100,000 people. And this is what it looks like now, after two dams and four bridges collapsed. Thousands of people are still missing. The mayor of Derna says he fears as many as 20,000 people may have died. Many people were asleep when their homes collapsed around them, and many were washed out to sea in the torrent. A warning, you may find some of the images in Quentin Somerville's report upsetting.
When the storm came, fractured Libya was ill-prepared. Half a year's rainfall fell in just 24 hours. In daylight, as much as a quarter of the port city of Derna was revealed to be gone. Engulfed by floodwater after two mountain dams failed. Families were washed out to sea as they slept.
Also in this region, you've got man-made crises that could prove even deadlier. You've got Niger and Mali that have gone through coups over the summer. Sudan is in a civil war that has forced an estimated 4 million people to flee their homes. You've got 6 million people on the brink of famine. And these are huge numbers. I mean, it's one of the sad facts of life that we're just used to mass-scale suffering in Africa. And so when it doesn't make the news because it's not new, I guess, or I mean, newspapers and websites, they're all profit enterprises. I guess they just don't get clicks. But there's a massive amount of suffering going on in North Africa. I mean, you've got Eritrea that is not talked about enough. That's basically Africa's North Korea, where you've got a horrific dictatorial regime and people trying to escape that. You've got Chad and the Central African Republic having serious problems with internal violence. You've got terrorist groups pledging allegiance to the Islamic State or to Al-Qaeda operating in Mali and Burkina Faso. So, yeah, I mean, what's going to happen if you've got millions starving, if you've got civil war, if you've got earthquakes and floods destroying people's homes, destroying a city of 100,000? Well, then, yeah, you get all of these migrants streaming to the north. And in the process, these same man-made crises, they're kind of dismantling a political border wall that Europe has built up in North Africa. And this is a subject I don't want to go off on too long, but it really annoys me. The way that European leaders get up on their high horse and they will talk to the cows come home about how evil Donald Trump is for wanting to build a border wall. And, you know, they've got all of these statements like, well, we're not about walls. You know, it's not Christian to build walls. You've got all of these different leaders. They'll talk about, you know, it's how wrong it is that Donald Trump wanted to build a wall or improve the wall with the US-Mexican border. And yet you look at what Europe's border defense policy is. They basically have formed agreements with all of these different countries, a lot of these different countries across North Africa and Turkey, to try and make this political wall, a wall of countries that keeps migrants out of Europe. And they literally paid a convicted war criminal, Omar al-Bashir. He's dead now, but Europe did this. They paid him to build concentration camps and put migrants in them. And they do that while talking about how immoral Donald Trump is because he's making a wall taller, and how evil Donald Trump is because he's making a wall taller. I mean, Europe gives guns to Turkish border guards and 4x4s and vehicles to Turkish border guards so they can shoot migrants. And of course, the US mainstream media, they're complicit in that. You know, massive wall-to-wall coverage about some discussion of, did American border guards use horse whips against people coming across the border from Mexico? Europe is literally giving guns to Turkish border guards and saying, go shoot migrants. Spiegel's had features on it. Not picked up at all by the US press. Not really a huge amount of interest in the European press. And look, a country has a right to defend its border. And I'm not even necessarily, if you want to do what keeps migrants out. Yeah, you know, you have a right to defend yourself. But for them to defend themselves in these ways while trying to make Donald Trump into a monster while he's doing something much more mild is just such rank hypocrisy. And yet all of the media goes all along with it. Anyway, I knew I'd talk about that too much. So my point here for today is, though, that this border wall that Europe has built, this kind of political, that's crumbled. Sudan's in civil war. Omar al-Bashir is gone. Niger's government is gone. Mali's government is gone. All of these not particularly pleasant governments, but they at least kept people further south, or they interned them. They stopped migrants from keeping on traveling north. They stopped migrants from reaching the shores of the Mediterranean. They're gone, and their countries are in chaos. So you've really got the potential for more and more migrants showing up in North Africa. And we've been seeing that. We'll talk a little bit. You know, we're seeing this feed into European news, but this is a long-term problem. You know, this could well be five times bigger than it is right now come next year, next spring, and you start to get the seas warm up and calm down and migrants start coming over. Like, this is set in the long run to only get worse. And look what the 2015-2016 migrant crisis did to Europe. You know, it took the Alternative for Deutschland from being this small, it's almost nerdy kind of economically focused party, and turned them into a mass movement. The Alternative for Deutschland had debates about interest rate policies and things like that. Was what they were excited about. And then they picked up on the migrant theme. That changed the party. It changed German politics because they just had this torpedo of support behind them. It propelled the successor to the World War II era fascist party in Italy into power. where you've got Giorgia Meloni with the Brothers of Italy, which is, it's a very direct descent from the fascist party, from a party saying, well, we're going to be the rebranded version of this party that came before. You've got a whole generation of politics in it. Like, basically anybody who's anybody in Italy who with kind of a shot at top power is consciously modeling himself on Benito Mussolini. I mean, I'm not just talking about Meloni. I'm talking about Matteo Salvini as well. Perhaps as a man, even more so. You know, he will speak from the same balconies and the same pose and copy the his speaking styles. That's how you be cool in Italy these days. That's how you be successful in Italian politics. And what happens, though, if you have, once we head into the second round of migrant crisis, where all those that talk tough on migrants are the government now, at least when it comes to countries like Italy. Or in Germany, where they're just basically, I guess, the official opposition. Or unofficial opposition, I should say. But really, if you don't like what's going on right now, the alternative for Deutschland is kind of the only alternative voice, you could say. And the European Union, they're already kind of falling about, squabbling over this. Germany announced this week that it was suspending its border free zone. They were reintroducing checks between the Poland and the Czech border. You know, Europe, it's meant to be this big, open, border-free travel zone. If you travel around Europe, it's hugely convenient that you can go to all of these different countries without having to get your passport out and go through customs and immigration. Practically, it's big for trade and things like that. But Germany said, nope, you know, we're reintroducing border controls with Poland and the Czech Republic because of worries about migrants. And then you've got Italy's Giorgia Meloni having a go at Germany, complaining that Germany is giving money to charities that go into the Mediterranean and rescue migrants. And she says, well, this encourages more migrants to come. And I think she's right. You know, they know that if they get a certain distance from, as long as their boat can get them away from the land, even if it's quite rickety, well, there'll be some of these charities will come, pick them up, give them a free ride over to the Italian shores. This is what Meloni wrote to Olaf Scholz in Germany. I have learned with astonishment that your administration, without coordinating with the Italian government, has allegedly decided to support with substantial funds non-governmental organizations engaged in the reception of irregular migrants on Italian territory and in rescues from the Mediterranean Sea. So she's really having a go at Germany for helping with this. Poland is seriously annoyed with Germany. Poland's cultural minister accused Germany of wanting to run all of Europe and accused Germany of interfering in the Polish election. Poland themselves is putting in the border checks with Slovakia. You get a bit of a crisis in Europe, and so quickly it's kind of this every man for themselves reaction. And this is really pushing, I mean, this is pushing Europe towards some big crises and some big changes. It's making clear that the European Union in its current configuration can't work. As an aside, I am kind of enjoying this punk Poland kind of attitude that we're having from Poland at the moment, where they're just standing up to everybody. They're having a go at Ukraine for cheap grain exports, and they're having a go at, they're picking fights with Germany. I think Poland is not generally one of history's winners, and they're not going to be this time around either. But there's something nice about seeing them start to build up this pretty big army in Europe and develop quite the backbone and kind of just have a go at everybody. It's not going to last, but it's an interesting moment in European history. But my point is, these hundreds of thousands of migrants, they're causing real problems. They're causing, all levels of politics. They're causing problems, whether it's your local area and your local swimming pool, to national politics, to European level politics. They're leading to different crises in countries. They're leading to social crisis. I mean, this is a much more serious issue than some of the things I've just kind of made light of, like Poland having a squabble with Slovakia. You look at some of the issues that we had in 2015 and 2016. And this is, I've been to Germany. I talked about how nice some of these German towns were in a few months ago when I was on this show. There's a lot of very nice German towns, and it all feels very safe and very open and very honest. I talked about kind of you take the train and nobody checks your ticket because they can kind of make this general assumption that most people are going to pay for their tickets. And you pour into this situation a whole bunch of migrants that start taking advantage of everything and making a lot of these areas demonstrably less safe. And then none of the mainstream politicians, you know, nobody wants to talk about this. And in fact, people are kind of told, well, if you want to talk about, if you have a problem with this, you're racist. And this does lead to some, this leads to some real problems. And you look at what happened, you know, infamously on New Year's Day in Cologne, where you had this this mass sexual assault going on from migrants. I saw another figure, I should have double checked it. I think it was saying that 8% of migrants that have come in from the Middle East are female. And this is, so when Europe took in migrants from Ukraine, most of them were women because they're fleeing a war zone. The men were going out to fight. This is very, very different. This is young Muslim men. Economically, I guess, they feel they've got a chance of a better life. They're coming over into Europe, and it's a very different dynamic. And so you've got people calling for answers in Europe that, yes, they empathize with the incredible suffering of those that are going on in North Africa. You know, they do, as I'm sure we all do, feel for those that, you know, like we saw in that clip, you know, the families washed out to sea in Libya, the people that have had their whole towns wiped out in Morocco, the people that have lost everything in coups or civil war, or the millions that are starving in Niger. Yes. You know, they don't hate those people. They have empathy for those people. But they know that taking in millions of young Muslim men into Europe is not the solution. You know, taking in exactly the kind of people that you would need to put in their energy and resourcefulness to fix these countries and turn them around, importing those into Europe is not going to help North Africa. And it causes all kinds of problems there. So you've got the situation where lots of reasonable people have very reasonable problems with what is happening in Europe. You know, it's not just neo-Nazis or extremists that are looking at what is happening to their towns and villages across Europe and saying, this has to stop. We cannot bring in any more migrants. We cannot allow any more migrants. We need to take firm action. But the problem is none of Europe's mainstream parties, none of their mainstream media even, will talk about this crisis. So people see the problems. The only places they can go for anyone that will do anything about it are the extreme parties. You know, some of these Alternative for Deutschland and Giorgia Meloni's group. And I think many of these extreme parties do have genuinely dangerous views. And I think it's causing then some of these reasonable people that see the problems with migration and see that none of the mainstream parties are talking about it, I think they're rethinking some things too. And they're starting to think, okay, well, maybe the problem isn't with democracy, it isn't with this political party or with the mainstream part. Maybe it's something fundamentally wrong with democracy. And we've got some stats I'll talk to in that as well. So a lot of these people that are concerned, they don't begin radical. They begin with very reasonable, very understanding, you know, exactly the same concerns I have about the UK. And you may have about your country, whether you live in the United States, UK, you're, you know, we all have these migrant problems. But the fact that in Europe, it's only the extremists that will talk about this. And that, you know, okay, people, there's people in America and in Britain that look at Donald Trump and say he's a Nazi and say he's extremist. And they look at Nigel Farage and they say that he's a Nazi and he's extreme. And it's absolute poppycock. But because they say that, and then these same people say the same thing about Marine Le Pen in France and Giorgia Meloni and the Alternative for Deutschland. There's a lot of people in Britain and America that look at the AfD and these other parties and they say, okay, well, people are saying they're neo-Nazi. Well, they say Donald Trump is a neo-Nazi. These parties are probably fine. It's, the AfD is just a German version of the Trump movement. That is really not true. Like, I get emails. Outlook is excellent now at having a built-in translator for Office 365. It has one button. I can translate emails. I get emails from a magazine that's very strongly associated with the Alternative for Deutschland. If you live in the United States, you would be astonished at the level of hatred that comes out from this. It's called Compact, this Compact magazine, that I get their emails every day they aim squarely at AfD leadership, you would be astonished at what they're spewing out. You know, like basically, well, not basically, they very literally did say that Eisenhower set up concentration camps to kill Germans after World War II. They had a whole article about how America was actually behind Germany's worst terrorist attack of the post-war era. It was Munich bombings in the 1980s. And they said, well, actually, America did. Like, this movement that I think a lot of people in America, understandably, because they've grown suspicious of the mainstream media and suspicious of these neo-Nazi accusations, that they view as, well, just a German version of the Trump movement, that is very wrong. It is not a German version of the Trump movement. And even someone like Giorgia Meloni, that's done a much better job of looking moderate of late, you know, she has these links that go back to Mussolini's party. And there's an involvement there that they want with the Catholic Church in it. You know, it's a different type of movement to what is happening in America. But, I mean, if we look at... this has been the dynamic since 2016. People in Europe have been pushed towards these parties that are genuinely extreme, and they've been rising in power. What if these parties fail to solve the problem? Where does Italy go from Giorgia Meloni? If we've still got a migrant crisis, and people are looking at that and saying that actually the successor to Mussolini's parties are not radical enough, where do we go from here? And for years, the West has been led by leaders with very similar principles and values, regardless of which country they live in. You know, they believe in free trade, free healthcare, confronting climate change, and tolerating or even encouraging migration. You know, and a whole bunch, these are kind of just the mainstream political normal. And they see themselves as tolerant, compassionate people. And if you don't agree with those, they view you as either intolerant or irrational. And in Europe, they've enshrined these ideas in law. It's not just national law. It's in international treaties. It's in foundational documents like the European Convention on Human Rights. This is a convention. It goes, you know, the United States has very limited basic rights, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, for very good reasons. I mean, I'm not going to go into the Federalist Papers right now. And I think many of you in America, you know this. There's some good thought behind what is in that declaration. And the European Convention on Human Rights, you know, these liberal elites, they see themselves as more compassionate than America's founding fathers. They give people more rights. And so there's a right to family life, and there's a right to this and a right to that. And so anybody who claims to be a refugee, they've got a right to claim asylum, and people have a right to clean air and water. And this leads to court cases that come along and shut down farming in a country. And when times are good, people go along with this. But times are not good. Times are getting worse, and people are getting fed up. And so this consensus of the ruling elite, it has a lot of power. It's embedded in the foundation of modern European states, in its constitutional law. It's right there in the founding principles of the Council of Europe and in the European Union. And the elites have spent decades ensuring that these principles are just fundamentally intertwined with the whole systems of government in Europe, national level, international level. And so you get when someone like Giorgia Meloni gets elected in Italy, who opposes mass migration and promises tough action, she's kind of stuck. She finds it very hard to follow through on those promises. And if you think about it, for Italy, there's a really simple solution to their migrant crisis. They could solve this tomorrow. You just take the migrants from Lampedusa and you put them back in Africa. You drop them off on a beach in Libya somewhere. Simple. Whether they're arrested in European waters, arrested on European shores, you just take them back. And arguably, this is the compassionate solution. You've got about 20,000 migrants that have died trying to cross the Mediterranean. That's just one estimate since 2014. Because they're taking off in all of these rickety boats, etc. I mean, if you just say all migrants go back straight back to Africa, you take away the incentive to make that journey. 20,000 lives potentially saved by that policy. And it's also completely illegal. This is why Giorgia Meloni hasn't done it under national, under international human rights laws, under the Council, the Council of Europe and the European Convention of Human Rights. Well, all these migrants, they've got a right to apply for asylum, and they've got a due process, and they can appeal. And with a million migrants arriving each year, that just completely overwhelms the system. They lack the resources to process these applications in any reasonable length of time. They can be appealed and dragged out. And you have cases in the UK where, you know, okay, well, this migrant adopted a cat in the meantime and he's got a right to family life. Therefore, he can stay here. Just these insane lefty lawyers coming up with these kind of arguments. And so most of these migrants are either allowed in or they just disappear before they can be deported. And so because of this, liberal elites have confronted the fed-up citizens of Europe with really two options. Accept indefinite mass migration and watch your state's welfare state collapse, your healthcare system that Europeans are so proud of collapse. Or I shouldn't have a bash at Europe. We are way too proud of our NHS system over here. It really is a false god in Britain too. But watch their culture completely change, their cities become dangerous, their friends attacked. Or they can break the law. They can find, I mean, they could maybe try and find a legal way to remove all of this constitutional protection for migrants from constitutional law and international treaties. That will take years. That will take at least a decade, maybe more though. I mean, something like renegotiating the European Convention on Human Rights. You've got to get like everybody that signed this thing in the first place to come along and agree to change it. That's a long, long process. And so basically Europe is going to have to surrender to mass migration or just smash the system. And as this crisis gets worse and it's not going anywhere, they're going to take the second option. They'll just smash the system. You know, Giorgia Meloni, if she's not willing to skirt the rule of law and start deporting migrants en masse or doing this kind of thing, well, she'll be replaced by someone who is. It's just not sustainable what's happening. And we're already, like I said, seeing this fundamentally alter European politics, and it's fundamentally changing people's attitude towards democracy and rule of law. And they're starting to equate democracy and rule of law with being ineffectual and unable to solve their country's problems. And I think a large part of the blame for that lies on these liberal elites that have bound up these kind of protections for migrants and others in this kind of fake human rights law just so fundamentally strongly with Europe's constitution and with the idea of democracy and the rule of law. So you had a couple of weeks ago, University of Leipzig, they did a big social study of Germans. They had some shocking results. 33% of respondents agreed with the statement, "We should have a leader who rules Germany with a strong hand for the good of all." A quarter said that Nazism has some advantages. 6% said they favored a right-wing dictatorship with a single strong party and one Führer, one strong leader for Germany. Basically, 6% said we want Hitler back. 23% said they agreed with such a dictatorship, at least partially. And for years and years, even in the years after the migrant crisis, it's only been about 2%. That this study has found have kind of been hardcore fans of dictatorship within Germany. And then quickly, I think it was either last year or 2021, 2022, it jumped to 8%. That was just this very hardcore dictatorship. And then and it was about 23% were the numbers that were kind of were more ambiguous. We like some elements of a dictatorship. It's a very quick jump. And of course, you know, the survey is right out right now. It's a very recent survey. The data is older. It's a big comprehensive survey. It takes some time to analyze it and things. So, you know, what is this looking at now? What is, you know, where are we going to go as this migrant crisis gets worse? Things like support for anti-Jewish views went from, or anti-Semitism went from 1.7 to 5%. Eurointelligence, they had a briefing about this, and they wrote, "It's not a corrupt conspiracy and a dysfunctional constitution that swept the Nazis to power in 1933. It was centrist coalitions that pursued austerity in the years before German political parties today, German political parties today have drawn wrong conclusions from the breakdown of the Weimar Republic. By refusing to enter coalitions with the AfD, they are repeating exactly the same mistakes their predecessors did in the early 1930s. They are only looking at 1933 when it was already too late. The political era occurred in the years before." They're looking at this and saying, we are repeating the history of the 1930s. We're doing the same thing that happened there. And the Alternative for Deutschland's strength comes from this 30% that are dissatisfied with democracy. And of course, migration isn't the only issue that's pushing people in this direction. you know, you've got big economic issues rising now. And then hand in that is this kind of green religion that's making these economic problems worse through some of its pursuit of environmentalism. Geopolitical Futures, they had an article. They said that Germans are currently confronted with significant demands that jeopardize their ability to meet their own expectations in terms of owning a car and a house and raising their children in a safe environment. They blame the government and the political system for not creating solutions and are therefore seeking alternatives. Instead of driving social change, they appear to be getting increasingly pessimistic with concerns over unemployment and other issues similar to those of the middle class, with other classes. So the whole point of their article was that the middle class is getting fed up not of this political party or that political party, but with the German system of government and democracy in Germany. And this is building into a real crisis within Europe, and a crisis that makes Europeans fundamentally alter their system and their system of government. This is what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote all the way back. This is December 1991. This is one of the very first issues of the Trumpet magazine. He wrote, "If a real crisis develops, will the Germans call for a new Führer? Your Bible says that is going to happen. That crisis will probably be triggered by an economic collapse in the US." So he said, we're going to get in, you know, this is where it's going. It's starting to be where we are now. And 6% calling for a new Führer, up from just 1 or 2. Around 30% having at least some kind of support for dictatorship. Economics playing a role in this, the migrant crisis playing a role in this. I mean, the Bible tells us to expect a big change in this system that's coming to Europe. And that change could happen very swiftly. I mean, I mentioned this migrant crisis will probably be way worse come next spring. And absolutely, I think it will. Things could come to a head even more quickly. I mean, you look at just how quickly people arrived in Lampedusa. Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 are full of prophecies that God gave about 500 years before Jesus Christ was born. And some of these prophecies became history just a couple of hundred years after Daniel wrote them. For example, in 323 BC, you had a great king of Grecia attack Persia, just as Daniel wrote in Daniel chapter 8. That was, of course, Alexander the Great. Daniel prophesied that. This is how we know that biblical prophecy is true and accurate, and we can rely on it today. It's already proven true and accurate and reliable. He forecast this, but so much of the book of Daniel, and really all of it, it says, well, the main thrust of this book is for the end times. It includes ancient history. This ancient history helps us know that we can trust it. But really, it's for us today. And Daniel 8, verses 23 to 24, describes the rise of a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences. Now, this is just one prophecy of a king, a strong man, rising in Europe. In his booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, "This soon coming leader could literally be called a king. Even if he's not, the Bible gives him that label. When the Bible talks about a king, in most places, it's saying this is not a democratic government. Even if he doesn't have that title, he's going to lead like a king. This vision in Daniel shows that the European Empire is about to become a lot more authoritative." And you could add a lot more authoritarian. Revelation 13 shows it's not just one king. It talks about 10 kings ruling under this overall strongman. It's a whole change in the European system. And Europe's not even 10 nations right now. It's 27 or 26, 20-something. A lot bigger than 10. I think we're 27. But anyway, I know that 27 is bigger than 10. That we can be sure of. There's a big shakeup that's coming to the European Union. And you see that in the way that you get this migrant crisis and immediately these different countries start squabbling. The current system, this current 27 nation, it's unsustainable. They're going to have to pare it down to a core group that come together and integrate much more closely. They're going to have to get the Catholic Church involved. Revelation 17 talks about a woman riding the beast. There's a church there that controls and guides it. I've got a quote. I think I skipped over it earlier. Yeah, this is from 1979. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote that the European Union has been totally unable to unite. In only one way can this resurrected Holy Roman Empire be brought to fruition: by the good offices of the Vatican, uniting church and state once again, with the Vatican astride and ruling. They've been somewhat reluctant to do that. They've kind of, I mean, the political leaders don't want to share power with the church. They'd rather have all that power for themselves. And so, yeah, so you get all of these crises, but then these crises are going to force them to take those steps that they've been unwilling to take, you know, to pare it down, to come together with this church, to completely change the system of government. I mean, there is a revolution coming to Europe. The Bible tells us what it looks like, and you can see the events getting ready to force it into exactly that mold right now. And you're going to see a smashing of the democratic system that currently dominates. The book of Daniel describes this coming empire as a beast. It's an aggressive, warlike power. It's not restrained by rule of law or diplomatic niceties. And so by enshrining this protection for migrants at the heart of European law, well, these liberals have guaranteed that their whole system is going to be brought down as a new generation of politicians confront these real problems that come from the migrant crisis. And because they've just put this human rights law at the foundation of so many of these European states, it means that foundation is going to be destroyed. We're going to see a very different Europe. Watch for this new Europe to rise rapidly. We've got our free booklet. There it is. A strong German leader is imminent. I'm looking in the wrong place in my notes. We'd be very happy to send that to you. You can read it online at our website, thetrumpet.com. Just go at the top right there to the literature tab, and then I think there's another menu to see all of the different literature that we have. There's a lot of books and booklets, but this will take you through these prophecies about this strong leader. You can give us a call, 1-866-930-3024. We'd be very happy to send you a physical copy, so you can order that on the website, or give us a call. Either one is fine. And you can shoot us an email, letters@thetrumpet.com. We'll take a short break. I want to use what little time that we have left to talk about a much more positive news story. And another one that I find fascinating from the James Webb Space Telescope. We'll be right back.
One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. What it will be like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. I wanted to talk about something I thought was just fascinating and really exciting from the James Webb Space Telescope. There's a new paper in the October edition of the Astrophysical Journal on, it's a study on early galaxies from the James Webb Space Telescope. I found this fascinating the whole time. Like, since last summer, we've been getting information on early galaxies from JWST. And I've just loved watching scientists' heads explode in real time. I mean, that's kind of what is happening here, where it's yet another result from this telescope on the early universe that is just completely at odds with the Big Bang theory and this kind of theory of galactic evolution. And it's causing some major problems for the scientists. This is a write-up that we've got here. This is from the Universe Today. I'll quote from that in a bit. They had a good write-up on this if you'd like to know more detail and don't want to wade through the Astrophysical Journal. But kind of the default way for scientists of looking at the way the universe happened and anything in the universe is that it's all a big accident. You know, that there was a big bang and then stuff came out and then just the stuff gradually came together into clumps. Your gravity pulls it together and this produces stars and galaxies, but it's all just kind of evolutionary and accidental. There's no purpose. There's no guiding hand. Now, there is law. They'll say that it's following law. They don't follow that up to say, well, where's the lawgiver? But it's just kind of this evolutionary process according to this law. That's just, you know, once you get enough stuff, well, then it ignites in a star and the star exerts a certain kind of pressure radiating outwards and these come together into galaxies. And already the James Webb Space Telescope has caused huge problems for this kind of general approach of galactic evolution. So almost immediately, James Webb started finding galaxies that were way too big for this model. Because again, if galaxies kind of evolve, you expect them to start small and get bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, you've got all this stuff fairly uniformly throughout the universe. And so you kind of coalesces into these small galaxies and they get bigger as they maybe merge and collide and things. But Webb started finding massive galaxies from just about as early as it could see. And at first, scientists just didn't want to accept this. And there was a lot of talk about, well, what's going on? Like, are the results skewed? Are we misinterpreting how bright they are or, you know, how old they are? And there's just been so many now, they've given up on that. It's like, okay, these are genuine. There's just a lot more massively big galaxies here. And, you know, basically, it looks like some of the pictures that we're getting from Webb, it looks like some of these galaxies are from 13 billion years ago. And according to these scientists, they say this is 300 to 400 million years after the beginning of the universe. I mean, maybe, maybe not. The Bible doesn't tell us how old the universe is. And so, I don't have a huge amount of confidence, I guess, in that age, but I don't really have any particular reason to disbelieve it. But according to this, you know, they believe, the scientists, they believe the first stars formed 250 million years after the Big Bang, and they believe that Webb is showing us pictures of galaxies 300 million years after the Big Bang. I mean, these should be baby stars and baby galaxies, and they're not. They're fully grown adults. You know, it's like looking at somebody that you're pretty sure is 30 years old, and you're looking at their one-year-old picture, and they're 6 feet tall. You're like, okay, this just didn't grow up naturally. There's something different. There's some other process going on here. Alexander Witzer wrote in Nature, the telescope's astonishingly sharp pictures have shattered astronomers' preconceptions about the early universe. That was last summer. There was another scientist who said that, you know, they thought it was a mistake. He said, but we've yet to find that mistake, despite a lot of trying. They put a lot of work into trying to kind of disprove these pictures. And so they expected that the very largest galaxies that they would find at this time period, the very biggest ones would be about a billion times the mass of the sun. That's how much stuff there would be in there. And they're finding them 50 times bigger than that. Like, it's not just they're slightly bigger or twice as big, way bigger. And they appear to contain old stars, not baby stars. You know, stars form by smashing elements, or they create energy by smashing elements together. If you've just got hydrogen, it's probably a young star. If you've got lots of other elements, it's probably an older star. They're also brighter than they're predicted by this Lambda CDM model of galactic evolution. The ingredients of these galaxies are wrong. This theory says that they should be mostly hydrogen, kind of the most simple element, and that over time, this hydrogen builds up into more complex elements, and that if you look into the earlier universe, there just shouldn't have been time for these old, more complex elements to be built yet. They're not finding any evidence of that. I love this quote. We've quoted this a fair bit. At least it's honest, from Alison Kirkpatrick, an astronomer at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. She told Nature, right now I find myself lying awake at 3 a.m, wondering if everything I've ever done is wrong. Have we got it all wrong? And this latest paper is more along that. So this paper is about the shape of galaxies. Now this is starting to question another part of this theory of evolution, because this theory of kind of galactic evolution, it says it's all chaos. You know, there's a big bang and then you've just got stuff flying and swirling around everywhere, and then it's coalescing into galaxies. And of course, if that's what's happening, well, then these galaxies are going to kind of have twisted and warped appearances and shapes, because it's kind of just emerging out of this chaos. They're not going to be nice and neat, because it's just this big swirling mass of gas that just came out of a big bang. And that's what they thought, that we'd have lots of irregular galaxies, lots of galaxies in all of these different chaotic patterns. And Hubble had some pictures, and they kind of did get that impression from the Hubble Space Telescope. But the James Webb Telescope gives us much more detailed look. They're getting a much clearer look at these older galaxies. And they're actually realizing that, no, they're surprisingly regular and normal looking. I think we've got just a comparison. And it's not as pretty as some of these other pictures that we can show you, just kind of a black and white thing that goes over some of these different, these different images that this is based on. If you just maybe just scroll down a little bit more. Here we go. This is it, where you can see what they've done is they've kind of taken some of these pictures. The picture looks amazing, but they've picked out now just one or these much smaller galaxies that are kind of in the background, and focused on them and looked at the different structure. And you can see you've got kind of the Hubble telescope ones over here. You've got Webb over here. The Webb images are much clearer, and they're really showing that these are neat, orderly disk galaxies for the most part. And these are a lot more common than we thought. So the lead author of this study, Leonardo Ferraria of the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Victoria, he said for over 30 years it was thought that these disk galaxies were rare in the early universe due to the common violent encounters that galaxies undergo. The early universe is kind of chaotic, according to that theory. He said the fact that the JWST finds so many is another sign of the power of this instrument, and that the structures of our galaxies form earlier in the universe, much earlier than anyone had anticipated. They're starting to realize this is all wrong. The universe today, where this article is, it says, it's difficult to overstate the significance of these results. They overturn our entire understanding of how galaxies formed and evolved. Prior to these observations, astronomers thought evolved disk galaxies didn't appear until 6 billion years after the Big Bang. I mean, these are billions of years too early, according to their theory. They had a co-author, Christopher Cornelis, from the University of Manchester. He says, using the Hubble Space Telescope, we thought that disk galaxies were almost non-existent until the universe was about 6 billion years old. These new JWST results push the time these Milky Way-like galaxies formed to almost the beginning of the universe. Orderly, sophisticated, evolved galaxies were there, as far as they can tell, from just about the start of the universe. There was no long stretched out period of evolution. There was the beginning of the universe, and then very quickly we had these sophisticated, orderly galaxies. He said, based on our results, astronomers must rethink our understanding of the formation of the first galaxy and how galaxy evolution occurred over the past 10 billion years. They have to fundamentally rethink everything. I mean, science is all about prediction and data. Does your what you predict match up with the data? This doesn't. Let me give you a prediction that was accurate. This is what Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker wrote before we'd received, this was right when Webb was launching last year. Plenty of scientists are sure to explain every image and data set that Webb sends, though it be the infrared signature of the creator himself, as proof there is no creator. But as the image and data provide an even clearer picture, there are many scientists who are turning to face reality. They are willing to look at the data in good faith and see what it actually teaches us, even where it further proves the universe has design and intent. Webb is literally ready to see invisible things from the creation. If it works, we're about to see power, beauty, and even more dazzling proof of the great God who made it and who made us. There is absolutely no other way that all of this could come together. Scientific knowledge is increasingly aligning with the description of creation contained in the Holy Bible. Looking at the cosmos, you are looking at the handiwork of God. With advanced telescopes and other extraordinary instruments, the more we learn, the more impressive it becomes. That was an impressively accurate prediction, because it was a prediction based on the Bible. It proved more accurate than these theories of galactic evolution. I mean, we can see the great creator and lawgiver all around us anyway, but we're getting an even better view of it with this James Webb Space Telescope. So keep watching for these fascinating results coming from this. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had a recent Key of David program. I mean, this is about the James Webb Space Telescope pointing you to God and your creator. His Key of David program talked about how it points to your future. There's something just incredibly exciting about that too, and that these pictures are bringing your future alive. You know, this universe, okay, if it's created by a God with order and intent and purpose, and that is really what these images and these studies from Webb are showing, well, what is that purpose? What is that intent? And this creator, well, he would have also created you. Do you have, does that galaxy, does that universe have any relevance to you? Well, that Key of David program shows that it does. We also have a booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential, that we're very happy to send you, that you can learn more about that with. That is about all I've got time for. If you want to order those, you can give us a call, 1-866-930-3024. You can visit us on thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you there. You can also shoot us an email, letters@thetrumpet.com. And please do that. We'll be very happy to hear from you. And please do remember to tune back in tomorrow here at the Trumpet Daily Show.